Okay, good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. So welcome to this second lecture of the third week of Applied Time Series Analysis course. Last week and this week, first lecture in this week, we have been discussing or using the basic assumption regarding our analyzed variables that they are stationary. So to put it simply, stationarity means that they have a constant sample mean. It can be zero, but it can be something different from zero also. And the variance is also more or less constant. And if you are using these kind of variables in a general linear regression model, so you're regressing a variable y against a set of other variables x that are all stationary variables, then you are basically able to use OLS type linear regression models. So your error term, residual series from that those regressions, it's behaving in a normal ways. It's a normally distributed, and it should have, if your model is good and you have all the relevant information on the right-hand side explaining the left-hand side variable, the expected value for the residual series should be zero. And it should have a constant variance in your sample. But what if we run into a situation that at least one or more of your variables might be non-stationary? So that means that basically the general linear regression model, the classical linear regression model assumptions regarding the residual series are not basically met, because at least one of your variables is kind of a problematic guy. It behaves completely differently compared to all the other variables in your sample. So it might be trending constantly in some subsample of your overall sample upwards, and in some other subsample, it might be trending downwards. Whereas all the other guys are behaving more like stationary. They do not have these trends, subsample trends upwards or downwards in any of the subsamples of your overall sample. So obviously, the smaller is your overall sample, the bigger is the problem that you might have these kind of variables in your data set. So can you do regression? Basic question is, can you do regressions of any kind? And the simple answer is that yes, absolutely. If you find non-stationarity based on your stationarity tests that we will be discussing today, it's not, you don't have to completely stop doing research at all. You just have to modify your data set to meet the requirements for stationarity for each and every variable. If you want to use, let's say, VAR type stationarity assuming modeling or approaches. So what to do, that's the thing that we are going to be answering today. What to do when you have these non-stationary variables? It actually opens up a possibility that when you have in your overall data set, you have at least two variables that are non-stationary. Together, they might form actually a linear relationship that is stationary. So they might be co-integrated. If they are co-integrated, then it actually also opens a possibility for you that you can build up a error correction model for these variables. And that is actually a very nice thing. If you find co-integration between the variables, you are able to separate the short-term effects from the long-term effects. The long-term effects are reflecting to the levels dependence between the variables, and the short-term dependence or short-term relationships is referring to the differences dependencies. So the variables in differenced form are in connection to each other. Locked values of the different series, difference series are in connection to each other. So in terms of economic models, actually, it actually opens up you, it opens new avenues for you to do the research in a bit, perhaps even much more sophisticated way than just focusing on a simple VAR representation of the data. So if you find non-stationarity, it's not actually a huge problem if you find non-stationary within a set of a bigger set of variables, because they might be co-integrated. So that actually opens up new possibilities for you in terms of doing the analysis. So stationarity is the thing that we are now focusing on. And actually, nowadays, I would very much encourage you always to actually, in your tables for descriptive statistics for the variables that you are analyzing, you should always obviously start your empirical analysis from drawing the figures for the variables. That is the case that I always use first, or the thing that I always do first. I draw the figures. I draw the time series figures for the variables. Are they related to each other at all? Already from those time series figures, you are actually able to perhaps detect the common trends between the variables. So say if, for example, term spread is going upwards at the same time as is the real economic activity or excess returns from the stock markets, for example. Are they trending upwards together and trending downwards together? So basically they might have a common trend, even though the trend is stochastic. It might be common to these variables, actually. That's the simple idea of possibility of co-integration. So they might be co-integrated, but they are not stationary in levels. So first you have to test for the stationarity in levels. So it's something that stationarity of a series, it's something that strongly influences its behavior and properties. So by definition, if we have a non-stationary time series, when we have a shock to that time series, let's say a positive shock, if it's a non-stationary, then it will have a permanent effect on the next observations after that. So if you are using these kind of variables in your regression models, you might end up into a case of spurious regressions, which means that in economic or financial terms, they should not actually have any kind of relationship between each other. But just by chance, in this sample, they seem to be trending together. There's no economic reasoning for the common trend between those, but just by sample, based on using this sample, they seem to be trending together. So that is a case for spurious regressions. You have to be able to detect this kind of behavior from your time series. And usually it's the case that if they are trending over time together, two variables, they the regression of one on the other one could have a very high R squared value. So the coefficient of determination is very high, even if the two are actually completely unrelated in some other subsample. So if you get to be obtaining much more observations from both of you, this common trend within a very short subsample might be vanishing when you get more observations. So that is the key idea there. So there's actually no relationship. It's very subsample specific thing. So if the variables in the regression model are not stationary, then it can be proved that the standard assumptions for asymptotic analysis will not be valid. So asymptotic analysis concerns the efficiency of the parameter estimates from your regression model. So basically the size of the standard error for the parameter estimates is depending on this phenomenon. So your T ratios might not be following the standard student's T distribution when you have unit roots in your data generating processes of the variables. So we cannot basically validly undertake these testing of these statistical significance when the standard errors of the parameter estimates get to be biasedly estimated based on the unit roots in the data series. So this is the main reason why we are so interested about the stationarity properties of the time series. And this is also one of the reasons why I always usually, and I have seen that many other applied time series econometricians also take it as a one set of descriptive statistics when they report the mean values for the time series and minimum and maximum values and standard deviations are perhaps tests for the normality of the time series. They always also report at least one test result for the unit roots or the stationarity. So usually the most usual one is the so-called augmented Dickey-Fuller test, and we will be discussing about this, all these tests today. What does a high R-squared value mean? So this is a simulation example of a regression of a non-stationary variable on another independent non-stationary variable. So there's no basically no any kind of economic reasoning why these variables should be in connection to each other. So here we have the R squared values for 1,000 sets, so 1,000 simulations of non-stationary. The only thing is in the data generating process for both of these variables is that in an AR1 type representation of the data, we have imposed the restriction to the AR1 coefficient to be almost one, or exactly one in this case. So, and still the residual series is behaving normally after that, but we have imposed that restriction and generated these observations completely randomly. And if they are unit root processes, you see that there are high percentages of actually very high R-squared ratios for the regression model in that case. So here's the value of the t-ratio on the same simulation exercise for 1,000 sets of regressions of non-stationary variable against each other. So the t-values get to be really very big. So you have lots of observations that are something different than zero, basically. So basically you have lots of indications that the variables might be connected to each other. So this is a problem. So there are various definitions of non-stationarity in the demonstrations. You will be using various formulations for the test equation regarding the unit roots or the non-stationarity existence of unit roots. Here we will be briefly discussing the most general cases of those. So in this discussion, we are actually referring to the weak form of stationarity, or the so-called covariance form of the stationarity. And there are basically two models which have been frequently used in the analysis to characterize non-stationarity. And you should actually now already be aware of this possibility that basically this is about doing an AR1 type regression for the levels of the variable, and we can either include the constant term. So if we have these kind of data generating process for Y series, then we have an AR1 process, so only one period lagged values are explaining the current observations, but with the coefficient of statistically significantly equal to one. So basically all the test procedures actually are built up based on this idea that we are testing whether in an AR1 model we have a coefficient on the lagged values of the regression, actually it to be one. If we have a drift or the constant series here, then we can actually discuss about, in financial time series terms, we can discuss about the random walk with the drift. So if you find a random walk with a drift in your time series, so you're not able to reject the null hypothesis that the coefficient on this one is exactly one, then you are basically handling or you are dealing with a time series that has some econometric problems or statistical problems, because you cannot basically use OLS type regression models for the statistical inference of that variable's dependence with some other variables. The other possibility is the simple deterministic trend process, which means that in this case, we are actually also building up a regression model for the contemporaneous observations of Y, but we are only using the trend here. So we are setting for each and every time observation. The first one is 1, second is 2, and third one is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, up onto the number of observations. And we are regressing that against the actual observations. And we are including also the possibility that the constant term might be statistically significant from zero. So this is a linear trend fit to the model. But both in these cases, actually, it should end up into a situation that the error term in these is identically and independently dependent in your sample. So you have a good residual from this model, actually, when you are modeling the behavior of the actual series using this representation. So obviously, always there's a possibility that you might not have a unit root, but still the series might be trending, but it's trending with the constant trend coefficient. So it's always positive, or it's always negative, that coefficient on the trend term. In this case, it can be positive in one subsample, and it can be negative in some other subsample. So it's a random, it's more like a random trend. So what are we referring to when we are discussing about the stochastic non-stationarity? We are discussing basically the regression models in using this AR1 type representation of the data. So basically, we are focusing on a very problematic situation that the coefficient of the lagged values might be equal to 1, or usually if it's bigger than 1, then we are in deep troubles, because it's an explosive process basically. When you have an observation of 1, let's say 1 for the first period, in the next period, if this coefficient is bigger than 1, then it's actually clearly more than 1 in the next period. In addition to the effect of the constant term, it's clearly more than 1 in the next period, and it's increasing all the time. The bigger is the more is the phi coefficient bigger than 1. So this is an explosive case. And usually we are not very much interested about this in function time series or economic time series, because it's very problematic. It's in connection to these exceptional periods in the time series data. We have these kind of observations actually in practice, like for example from this period of corona crisis after March 2020, we observed for a couple of months, for example, for the Standard & Poor's 500 and other general aggregate market indexes, we observed this kind of behavior actually, because it was coming down very rapidly. So if you have a daily data set for March and already actually for February and March 2020, you will be seeing this kind of behavior actually in the S&P 500, also in the stocks of the European markets. If you regress the behavior of the prices, not returns, but the prices, you actually observe this kind of behavior where you have a negative parameter estimate that is in absolute terms bigger than 1. So this is a simple idea in testing for the unit roots. If you are to make inference regarding the dependence of this kind of series, for example, on the other relevant information that should be affecting stock market valuation, like for example interest rates, then obviously the stock market prices are problematic for that subsample of March observations, at least in the daily frequency. You might not have the same kind of behavior in any other subsamples, like for example, for July and June and May last year, prices were already increasing quite a lot, actually. So there clearly was a stochastic trend in those prices. It was downward sloping in the early months of the corona crisis, and then it started to increase continuously after that. It's a very stochastic trend, you can say that. So in many cases, actually, when we test for the unit truth, for the prices, for example, an S&P 500 in the daily data for 2020, we probably are able to find unit truths there, not necessarily, depending on the sample size. But if we are focusing to a small enough subsample, you might get this kind of result that you have a unit truth there. But usually this assumption that in absolute terms, this phi that would be bigger than one does not describe many data series in economics and finance. If you are a sophisticated researcher, you try to get a as large as possible sample series from your for your data. This property has an actually, it's quite unappealing in the sense that when you have a shock to the system, they are not only persistent through time, they are propagated each period, so that the given shock will have an increasingly large influence from that period onwards. So it's clearly a problem. It's describing an explosive time series for that sample. Stochastic non-stationarity, what does it refer actually in terms of the AR1 representation that we have been discussing? Let's consider a more simple case where we don't have the constant term in the AR model, so we don't have this drift term, so we are just focusing on the random walk, but no drift. Assume different values for this AR1 parameter here. So basically, it should be the case that all the lagged values are in connection to the values before that observation based on this phi parameter here. So yt minus 2 is equal to phi times yt minus 3 plus the error term from that period. So if we substitute that into the original model, we get this kind of representation. So obviously, the size of this phi parameter estimate is actually very relevant here. The bigger is the size, the slower is the decaying structure in the effects of the past observations. So if we make a successive set of substitutions of this kind, we will end up into this kind of situation. So where the higher is the phi there, the actually lower is the effect of the first observation. And the effects of the last error terms actually start to be dominating here. So basically, this actually should give you an idea that the shocks that appear in the history of the time series, actually, they get to be having the dominating role. The original, the starting value of the actual observation or the actual series gets to be very low because this guy here is raised to the up to the power of t. And so the longer is the history that you are using, the smaller is the effect of the very first observation of the actual series. And the bigger are the effects of the most recent shocks in the time series. So that is actually should be giving you an idea about the relevance of this non-stationarity idea in the data series. So the impact of shocks is really important for non-stationary and stationary time series. So we have three cases here. If we can statistically significantly say that we have a stationary process here, so the coefficient on the lagged value is clearly below one. So obviously this also applies to the case where the the longer is the data sample, the smaller is the effect of the original observation here, phi to the power of uppercase T. As the size of the sample increases, the lower is the effect of that. So the shocks to the system gradually die away because the shocks to the system are reflected here in the behavior of this UT series. So the less gradually they die away, the higher is the phi. The more gradually they die away, the lower is the phi. So another case, referring to the case of non-stationarity, is the case where we have the unit root in the time series. So the coefficient of the lag values in the AR1 presentation is exactly one. Statistically significantly, we can say that it is exactly one. So then the effect of the first observation is always one for each and every observation that you are considering. The effect of the first observation is exactly one. So exactly one times the original, the first observation of the data series. That is the first observation effect. So shocks persist in the system and never die away, actually. So we obtain this kind of representation based on the last equation. So the shocks are here actually vary. After the first observation, all the shocks have a role. They have a persistent effect in the system and they basically never die completely away. Just an infinite sum of past shocks plus some starting value of y zero, each and every observation. So this is basically kind of a problematic situation if you have one variable that is behaving like this and all the other variables are more like behaving like this. And the most problematic case is that if that individual problematic guy is behaving like an explosive process, that is referring to the case of phi being bigger than one. Now, given shocks become more influential as time goes on, since this phi is bigger than one, then always these terms here get to be increasing. So that is really, really problematic thing, actually. And you can have these kind of findings in the actual data if your sample is small enough. So if you take a look at the subsample of the prices in stock markets, for example, in Europe and US from March, April, they came down very rapidly, but after that, they have been increasing more or less steadily. Not in such a huge phase or not in such a fast speed as the drop was in March and April, but they have been increasing nevertheless. And for example, the near-term stock market uncertainty indicators like the VIX and V-stocks from the European markets, they have been lowering also in connection to the continuously increasing stock prices. We are living kind of a strange times at the moment in terms of the discounting ideas of the stock market behavior, the dividend discount model, but it is actually rational behavior when you take into account the effects of unconventional monetary policy actions. I have just written a paper with a colleague of mine on this theme, and this is actually the behavior in the stock prices is actually, it's rational if you take into account the effect of unconventional monetary policy actions through their effects on the fares of rare disasters of the investors. So if you're interested about these things, take a look at a paper that I just downloaded yesterday to the ResearchGate and Social Science Research Network with Vance Martin. So detrenching a stochastically non-stationary series, how do you do that? So we had these two characterizations. The first one here is referred to these time-varying trends or these stochastic trends representation, and here is the linear trend representation for a stationary process. So these are basically referring to kind of a non-stationary series, so YT is in both cases, it's a non-stationary, but in this case, it seems to be actually possible to deduct or extract a stationary component by extracting the constant trend term from the data series. But these actually require completely different treatments to induce stationary. So this is just trend detracting, and this is something else. The first one here is something else. The second one is known as a deterministic non-stationary, and what is required is detrending. You just extract the effects of the trend. First case is the one that is perhaps even more problematic, because it's a it's a stochastic case of non-stationarity. So the usual way to test for this possibility is to try to build up some kind of test equation for this. If we use this one, the parameter estimate on this lagged effects is actually, it's a problematic thing. So we should actually be somehow able to use a representation for the regression model that actually has stationarity in terms of the regressant as the fundamental idea. So let's take a difference. Let's take a difference of the original series YT, which means that we are calculating the observations from the current period minus the observation from last period. So generate the series for the last observations and calculate the difference between the current and lagged observations. You can use this lag operator, it's exactly the same thing. So basically using this lag operator, we can give this representation for the differences using this equation also. But it's exactly the same here. So if we take this equation one and subtract the one period lagged levels observations from both sides here, so we can get to the difference equation or difference values on the left-hand side. And the thing that is being left on the right is the constant term. Now, if we have unit root, only one unit root in this time series, then this guy here is actually behaving stationary in a stationary way, assuming that we have a unit root. So the null hypothesis for all there's these standard tests of stationarity or non-stationarity is that we have this problem. We have a unit root in the data generating process of YT. So basically, the simplest possible way would be to test whether this constant term is there significant or not for the difference values of the original series of Y. And trend stationarity and difference stationarity, they are both trending over time. The correct approach needs to be used in each case. So it might be, if you have a single trend in the series, it might be actually enough for you to just detrend that based on that linear deterministic trend. But if you have suspicions that it might be stochastic trend, it's going upwards for some subsample and it's coming downwards for another subsample, then basically it should be the case that perhaps you should use this actual differencing test. So if we first difference the trend stationary series, it would remove the non-stationarity, but then we will be introducing an MA1 structure into the model. And vice versa, if we try to detrend the series with a stochastic trend, then we will not remove the non-stationarity actually using just the linear detrending. So you would have to consider the difference series and do testing for that. So let's now concentrate on the stochastic non-stationarity model, since this determinist case is in many cases, it's not enough. You don't have just a linear trend, one linear trend in your, it's not trending upwards all the time in your sample. It may be coming downwards also for a subsample. So basically in one subsample, it might be trending upwards and in some other subsample, it's coming downwards. So this is actually introducing this possibility of randomness to your series. So it's not relevant. So here we have a nice case. The first thing that I always encourage you to do in all your time series analysis is when you start doing your home assignments, for example, draw the figures first. So this is a nice series. It varies around the constant mean, and the mean in this case is actually zero because we are now have generated the series for a white noise process. So its expected value is actually zero, and it's varying more or less constantly in all the subsamples around the zero. More or less, you don't have any kind of variance clustering, for example, so the variance is not big for a longer extended period of time, and it doesn't go to a small variance for another extended period of time, so you don't have any kind of clustering. So this is a white noise process. Then the problematic guys are here. We have generated random walk series and a random walk with drift series in this case. Random walk series is the one here that would seem to be like trying to go towards the zero, but because it's a random walk, then the shocks to the series are always having an effect continuously. So basically, you are now able to construct or extract these time varying trends. So for this subsample, actually we see that it's upwards sloping, the trend it's upwards sloping, but much more for this subsample actually. It's coming downwards for this subsample, and again it's going upwards in this subsample. So it's very much a time varying stochastic like trend. Here is a random walk with drift, so for the exactly same time series, but with the difference that we have a statistically significant constant term for each and every observation. So it is higher by a positive constant term, but the behavior of the series is exactly the same. So basically, if you were to use only this subsample, you might actually even get to a situation where you might actually have a stationary series, but when you are extending your sample, it actually turns into a case where you have varying trend in the time series. It's going for longer periods, it's going upwards with the changing actually slope of the trend. It's coming then downwards and then starts to go upwards again. Financial and economic time series, in most cases, when you consider price levels of, for example, stock prices, or other prices like derivatives prices, they behave like this. And this is simply now giving you an idea that when you analyze the dependence of the financial market variables from each other or other variables, if you use the prices, you should have a very good grounding for using prices, because most likely the prices are not stationary. And actually the theoretical models that we are using in financial economics or financial econometric analysis are usually based on focusing on returns. As you remember, for example, capital asset pricing model and APT models and all the extensions of the pricing models like consumption capital asset pricing model, term structure of interest rates, for example, they are focusing on the interest rate kind things. So they are focusing on returns, not on prices. So if you start your analysis using prices, you should have taken a very close look at the data, whether it's stationary or not. If your price series is stationary, then obviously you can use those in levels, but do the unit root tests first. So here are some plots for various stochastic processes. So this is an example of a deterministic trend process. The idea is that the trend is constant. The coefficient on the trend is constant in your sample. It's upward sloping. It doesn't change to be lower here. It's exactly the same if you were to use these subsamples. The same coefficient on the trend can be estimated for the first 200 observations, as can be estimated for the next let's say 270 observations here in the rest of the sample. This is the idea of the deterministic trend. Here's an autoregressive process with differing values for the phi. So the problematic case here is that blue line. There we have imposed the unit root to this. The other guys here, 0.8 coefficient on the AR1 lacked observations, it's actually producing a more or less stationary series that is concentrated or varying around its mean value. And this yellow line in here doesn't show up very, very nicely, but it's also a reflection of a stationary time series there. It's close to zero. So basically, already also from this figure, you are able to see that the characterizing thing that the characterizes the non-stationary series is the time-varying trend within subsamples. We have lots of possibilities to estimate the trend. So it's very much a stochastic kind of a trend. It's completely dependent on the chosen subsample that you are using. So definition of non-stationarity means that we are focusing originally on this simple AR representation of the data and imposing the idea that the coefficient on the first period lacked values might be actually one. It's equally possible to analyze this in the form of differences. So we can generalize this concept to consider the case where the series contains more than one unit root. More than one unit root means that taking just the difference of the series is not enough to produce a stationary series. You have to take the second difference. So take the difference of the difference values. Take the difference twice. If you need to do that, then the original series, for example, for the stock prices, should be behaving like an explosive series, actually. And if you end up into this kind of situation in your data, then stop there and start to discuss the exceptionality of the time series period that you are considering. Then you find two unit roots. So if your return series is still a unit root process, then go back and take a look at the graphs of your price series. Do they behave like an explosive process? But nevertheless, it might be actually, in terms of the interpretation of your model, it might be even relevant that you use twice different series of the original price series. And you get stationarity, so you can use that problematic series now, originally problematic series in combination with other variables that are actually might be stationary already in levels. So if a non-stationary series YT must be difference D times before it comes stationary, it's said to be integrated of order D. So we write the notation is to write it that YT is behaving like an IT process. So if YT is behaving like an IT process, then taking a difference D times produces a stationary I0 process or I0 process. So I0 process is a stationary series and I1 series contains one unit root. So the representation for the data is like this. Characteristics of I0, I1 and I2 series. I2 series contains two unit roots, so it would require differencing twice to get it stationary. And they can wander, I1 and I2 series can wander a long way from their mean value and cross this mean very rarely. I0 or I0 series should cross the mean frequently. And when you take the practical applications or analyze the practical data series that you usually have, for example, from financial markets, usually the higher is the frequency of your data, the more likely it is that it is actually stationary, at least in returns. When you analyze return series, for example, from stock markets, if you have daily returns, the usual case is that it is stationary, actually. Because the data frequency is so tense. It's actually removing the long-term trends or long-term stochastic trends from the observations. But if you calculate from price observations of at the daily frequency, you calculate, for example, weekly returns or monthly returns or even quarterly returns, and the original series is daily, the lower frequency returns that you calculate from the higher frequency, they can contain actually unit roots. So you absolutely have to, even though the original daily series is stationary, and you can actually prove that by taking or doing the unit root tests, you absolutely have to also do the unit root tests for the lower frequency series of the returns, because they might contain unit roots. Majority of economic and financial series contain a single unit root, although some are stationary and consumer prices have been argued to have even two unit roots in some very short samples. Basically, this is very much when you are discussing about macro variables like your consumer prices. If you are taking a look at, let's say, South American countries like Argentina, for example, at the moment, the general price level series there definitely has two unit roots because it's explosive. It's even increasing on a daily basis. So it all, even in a daily basis of the price level quotations in some Southern American countries, you have two unit roots in the data generating processes. It's only rational to find that because the prices are increasing all the time, very heavily. So the money is losing its value there. Purchasing power of money is really weak in those countries at the moment. How do we test for the unit root? The standard test or the most frequently used test is this Dickey-Fuller test. And you usually actually use the augmented version of this. But basically the idea is to use this regression that actually if you have a unit root in the series, so it is relevant to take the difference and you are able to prove that it is holding, then this residual in this regression model should be behaving nicely. So it has an expected value of zero and constant variance, and it's not autocorrelated in an augmented case actually. So basically it's behaving well. So you can do the inference. So the test of phi equals one in this regression is equivalent to a testing of this phi equals one in this regression is equivalent to testing for the null hypothesis of psi coefficient on this lagged value of yt. The reason why we want to use this representation is that this now is stationary. So the inference based on this is based on this not standard t statistics, because Dickey-Fuller and others have proven that it's not exactly behaving like the student t distribution. The critical values are a bit higher in absolute terms, but basically the tables or the distributions are more like more or less the same. Critical values are a bit different. So we are testing now using these, actually this augment, this Dickey-Fuller test for testing of that. And they are also reported in many programs. These Dickey-Fuller tests are reported using this tau mu or tau tau cases. And it's actually now referring only to the alternative hypothesis. So in the tau case, we are using as an alternative hypothesis that instead of non-stationary process, the alternative is that it is actually stationary AR representation. And in this tau mu case, we are imposing the possibility that the alternative representation of the data is an AR1 with the constant term. And in the last test value, we are actually imposing the possibility that the series is actually an AR process with a constant term and deterministic trend also. But the main thing for you to understand here is that always the null hypothesis in the Dickey-Fuller test is for the presence of unit root. So the null is that there is a unit root, so it's a non-stationary process. Okay, so this last one is actually a test for a random walk against a stationary AR1. So this is a random walk, and it's always in each and every case, it's a random walk, it's a null hypothesis, and the alternative hypothesis is something else. AR1 or AR1 with constant or AR1 with constant and time trend. Most of the programs report all these possibilities, but the main thing for you to understand here is that always the null hypothesis is the non-stationary. So when you compute the Dickey-Fuller statistics, you use this regression model, and the alternative may be expressed in the most extensive case, so the last case for this one. So we are now calculating the t statistics actually for this parameter estimate xi. And Dickey and Fuller, or Fuller actually originally in Journal of Time Series Analysis publication, used Monte Carlo experiments to construct the critical test values for the Dickey-Fuller t ratios. And he was able to prove that they are a bit different compared to the standard usual t distribution under the null. So it's the null hypothesis, because the null hypothesis is non-stationarity, it follows a non-standard distribution in terms of the critical value. So the distribution actually looks like a t distribution, but it only has these critical values to be a bit different compared to the standard. So if you refer to at the 5% significance level, you are analyzing the significance of a parameter estimate from a standard OLS regression model where you don't have unit roots in the variables, the critical value are around 1.96 for the t statistics, but Fuller actually proved that in case of non-stationary series, they are bigger. So the acceptance or the confidential confidential levels are higher, so the intervals are higher there. So here are the actual examples, and nowadays you don't have to anymore go and take a look at these critical values that were originally reported in the Fuller's paper. When I did my first unit root tests at the end of 1990s. When I started doing my master's thesis, I had to take a look at these book values because the programs, econometric programs, didn't at that time report them readily from the outputs, but nowadays you don't have to take a look. Just take a look at these that you obviously see that if you have the reference or the critical decision level for your statistical inference is, let's say, this 5%, then in standard cases, the critical value for this is around 1.96, and this is a one-dimensional test for testing the unit roots. We only consider the negative values. So if you get the result that your t statistics, the Dickey-Fuller t statistics is below minus 2.86, then you get at the 5% level, you get to be rejecting the null hypothesis of unit root. So it's rejected in favor of the stationary alternative in each case if the test statistics is more negative than the critical value. These tests are only valid if the error term in the test equation is white noise. So in many cases, actually, we nowadays use this so-called augmented Dickey-Fuller test to take care of the problem of possible autocorrelation in the residuals. And this is very, very strict, very standard way of doing the augmenting procedure here. We just add lags of the dependent variable. The main idea is here still the same. The regression model or the test equation or testing is actually imposed to the testing of the value of xi once again. So the levels, lagged levels of the yt are of interest to us. So the test equation is exactly the same, but just to be able to take care of the possible autocorrelation in the residuals, we introduce the lagged values of the dependent variable, which is the difference in the actual series, we introduce those to the model. But the critical values are exactly the same. They do not change at all. And this was also proven by Dickey and Fuller in a later paper from 1978. So the problem here is actually, what is the relevant lag length? Because this is now resembling us also, it reminds us from the problems in the deciding the relevant lag lengths in the AR models and VAR models also. And nowadays, actually, the most straightforward way to determine the optimal lag length is to use the information criteria. And the econometric programs nowadays, actually, they do that more or less automatically. Not all econometric programs, actually. Stata is not able to do this, but for example, R and WinRATS, you have these automated procedures to choose the optimal lag length here. So how many lags do you have to include from the left-hand side variable to get rid of the possible autocorrelation in the residuals in the regression model? And nowadays, we usually use the information criteria. In early days, when I had to do this manually, when I was using multi-data, I had to take a look at the frequency. So I had the monthly data, and I included 12 lags. Usually, but it in many cases resulted to over-parameterization of the model, but it doesn't hurt in this case because the critical values are exactly the same in the Dickey-Fuller tables, regardless of the number of lags. Testing for higher orders of integration, what does this mean? It simply means that you do the same augmented Dickey-Fuller test, for example, for more and more differenced series. So the null hypothesis stays here always the same. So if you end up in accepting the null hypothesis in the first differenced series, then take the difference of that first differenced series and then impose the Dickey-Fuller test or augmented Dickey-Fuller test to that twice differenced series. And do the testing up until you get to a situation that you reject the existence of unit root in the series. So you reject the null hypothesis. So basically, this is just taking more and more differences up until you get to a situation where you reject the null hypothesis. The other possibility to do this test is actually the Phillips-Perron test. It was developed almost at the same time as the Dickey-Fuller test. It uses a more comprehensive theory in terms of the statistical theory behind the construction of the test statistics. Tests are similar to ADF tests, but they incorporate an automatic correction to the Dickey-Fuller procedure to allow for autocorrelated residuals. So usually, basically, actually, Dickey-Fuller and Phillips-Perron tests end to be using more or less similar lag structures in the augmentation of the test equations. Usually, they give same conclusions as the ADF test. So it's about just decision about whether to use this ADF test or to use the Phillips-Perron test. I usually report at least one of these, and then I report the so-called KPSS, Kwiatkowski-Phillips MIT test that we'll be discussing soon here. First, we have to take into account that there has appeared some kind of criticism against these simple unit truth tests. And the main criticism comes from the finding that the power of this test is low if the process is stationary, but with the unit root close to the non-stationary. So in some cases, people have been developing these called fractional integration tests, where you have problems to make a decision between whether you have the unit root or you have a close to unit root series. For example, among the Finnish econometricians, for example, Markku Lanne and Pentti Saikkonen at the University of Helsinki have been discussing about these models quite a lot. So if you're interested about those, you can take a look at those also. But in any case, since this is more like nowadays a one part of the descriptive statistics of your data, I would suggest to you that don't pay too much attention to this criticism of the unit tests, especially in cases where you have clear indications from all the tests, let's say augmented Dickey-Fuller test and Phillips-Perron test, and perhaps this last test that we'll be soon discussing, this KPSS test, that you have either stationarity or non-stationarity. You don't have to go into more, let's say, detailed analysis of in terms of the size of the unit root. Is it exactly one or something else? So it has been discussions about that, but one of the solutions for these critical discussions has been that in applied econometric analysis or applied financial econometric analysis, we usually do also these stationarity tests. And this is something that has been developed by Kwiatkowski, Phillips, Schmidt, and Shin in 1992. The main difference is there that the test statistics behave a bit differently compared to these ADF and Phillips-Perron tests. And the most important thing for you to realize from this is that this test actually imposes the null hypothesis of stationarity. So basically, the other tests have the null hypothesis that the series is non-stationary, whereas this is the testing vice versa. It's stationary. So we can compute the results of these tests with the, or compare these test results with the ADF and PP procedure to see if we obtain the same conclusion or not. And there are basically, in these cases, when we compare these tests of with the null of non-stationarity, so we have unit roots here in the null hypothesis, and here we have in the KPSS case, we have the null hypothesis to be assuming that the series is stationary, then we obviously have these possibilities that in this case we would like to reject the null hypothesis and we would like to, in this case, accept the null hypothesis. So in this case, it is clear that we have a stationary series. Here, we do not reject the null hypothesis, so we have a unit root, and here we reject the null hypothesis that it's stationary, so this is also supporting each other. So we have a unit root in the series. But the problematic cases are these ones. And in those cases, it might be actually relevant to take a look at whether you have this fractional integration in your data series. But in these cases, go back to your original data. How does it look like? Is it relevant to have an assumption that it is actually stationary? If you do some kind of detrending for the data, for example, you take a constant trend away from that, are you able to get to a situation where you actually have a stationary series? So this is one of the standard things nowadays that you basically have to do in all your time series analysis at one point of your analysis. It's so standard way of starting your analysis nowadays that in some cases, researchers even don't report the actual test statistics. They just mention that in the footnote that, by the way, we tested also for the stationarity and were able to find out that based on these test statistics, the series are stationary or not. If they are not stationary, then we use the difference values. But it is relevant to do because your statistical inference is misleading if you are using the original time series in a wrong form. You are using levels instead of using differences when the unit root is there in the levels. So it's giving you wrong inferences because you are actually using spurious regressions for the part of this variable. So let's now, before having a break, let's take a look at this practical example. So I will stop sharing. I have instructed you to take a look at these results already yesterday. I hope at least someone of you would have taken a good look at the results. So we can go now, and I will start sharing the code page here. So can you see now my code? Can you see the RATS code that I'm using here?
Yes.
Okay, so I just print out, or I will run these unit tests, and you have these same results here actually in the Word file, so you can, if you have printed that or you are able to see that from another screen, so take a look at that. So we are once again using this same data set that we have been using the earlier examples in this lecture. So let's now start reading the data in and calculate the variables there. I won't go through these because we have gone already these many times in these. So I just calculate all the variables here, and I don't even draw the figures here, even though I calculate the variables. So we are now testing for the unit roots. I will give this data or this code in the Moodle site also for you to do. Let's first instruct the program to use the data sample as a whole. Obviously, if you want to do some subsample testing for this, then you just have to impose the sample to be something at the end of these instructions for doing augmented Digifuller test and other tests. We are interested here first about the Euro real economic activity at 12-month horizon. So the changes in the industrial production, 12-month changes in the industrial production are in the focus here. And in RATS, it is very easy to do this because we have these procedures that you can download actually from the Estima website. So basically, I have downloaded this before doing, so it's here in my folder. I will call for that. And the way to do this, I will stop sharing this and I will go to a website that where you are able to find all these things. It's the Estima homepage. So are you able to see now my that homepage?
No.
So I will have to start sharing this one. So share screen, and it's that one. Now you should be able to see this one.
Yes.
So you can go here and take a look at various sources or resources regarding, and for example, these have been downloaded from these procedures and examples page here, and you can go to the browser here, and then you are using the version 10 of the program and select the subject here. I will select the unit roots, and that's there, and reset then this list, and it will give you a set of many kind of unit root tests. Are you able to see this listing now?
Yes.
So you can go and find there, for example, this URADF procedure and just download this one. So it's a readily available procedure. It takes care of the optimal lag length that is being used in the ADF test, and it uses the information criteria. And I will start sharing now the RATS results. So I will go there once again, and you can download all these procedures from that website. Do you see now my code again?
Yes.
Okay. So the main thing that you take a look at here is that you have these joint tests of a unit root and no constant on the constant, and these all various possibilities for the unit roots, but the test statistics are basically the same. They are just adapted to this inclusion of this additional. But the thing that you have to take a look at is the first one here. This is the standard Digifuller test statistics. The main thing that is being taken care there is the number of lags. So here it's reporting also the critical values. These actually are exactly the same as we actually discussed in the slide from the Fuller page or the Fuller paper. It's doing the analysis for this data sample. So what can you say about the existence of the unit root in this series? Do we have in this Euro area real economic activity, do we have a unit root or not?
No.
Yes, that's correct in France, because this is clearly below, even at 1% risk level, we can say that we don't have a unit root there. What about the Phillips-Perron statistics? Now that I have downloaded this to the same folder, this other procedures tour, the program starts to be looking for whether there is the, in the same folder, there are these others, and it finds them there. And what about the Phillips-Perron test? It also reports the critical values first, and then the actual lag statistic, the test statistics. It's using actually a bit different lag structure here. It's using four lags. But what can you say about the existence of the unit root? Do we have a unit root there or not?
If we use 5% significant level, then yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, if we have, yes, if we have this 5%, at the 5% significance level, we are actually able to reject already. But at 1% risk level, not. I think you were referring to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the test statistics goes there in between minus 3.46, that is at the 1% risk level, and at the 5% level, the critical value is minus 2.87. And it goes in between. So at 1% risk level, we would like to be 99% sure that we are doing the right inference here. We are not able to say that. But at 95% confidence interval or 5% risk level for in ending up to doing the wrong decision, we are actually able to say that it's not containing a unit root. So the results are not exactly the same. This actually gives you reason to also take a look at the test that involves the null hypothesis of having a stationary series. So what can you say about this? If you want to take a look at the actual procedure, you can open this procedure after you have downloaded it and take a look at it, the file, kpss.src file, actually. What is it actually doing there? It also gives the references to the paper, actually. So if you are interested about those, but the main thing for you to understand is now that you get these kind of test statistics and the critical values are here. And the null hypothesis is for stationarity. What can you say? Is it the stationary or what?
It is stationary.
Yeah, we are accepting the null stationary, null hypothesis of stationarity clearly. So it is now actually supporting the original result or the first result from the ADF test, actually. So we can say that this real economic activity series might seem to be behaving like a stationary series. What about the interest rates? Let's do first for the short-term interest rate out of curiosity. So we have all the results here. Let's start from the Dickey-Fuller test here. It's for the interest rate in the euro area. What can you say about whether it's stationary or not?
It seems like it is non-stationary.
Yeah, it seems like a non-stationary unit root process. What about the Phillips-Perron test? Do you get the same inference?
Yes.
Yes, you get. And what about KPSS?
Yes.
Yes. So definitely it seems to be the case that the short-term interest rate is a problematic guy here. If you want to use that in a linear regression model where you have real economic activity involved also, you have to take a difference of the short-term interest rate. So obviously, if the short-term interest rate is being used as one component, actually, when you calculate the excess return for the stock markets, it might actually be disturbing the behavior of the stock market returns variable also. So let's now next test for the existence of unit roots also in the stock market excess returns. What can you say about that? based on the augmented Dickey Fuller test, is there a unit root in the excess returns from the stock markets?
There might be, yes.
Yeah, there might be at the 5% level. You are actually doing an inference that there is a unit root, but what about the Phillips-Perron test? Does it give the same inference?
No.
Not exactly, but close. It's very close. So this is actually one of the reasons why in these cases you have to do also this alternative test statistics to get the final conclusion whether you have a unit root in the series or not. And what would this KPS test actually indicate?
We do not have a unit root.
Yeah, exactly. It says that it is a stationary series. So obviously after this, you would be probably using these excess returns as such without taking a difference, but you would have to actually dig deeper whether the probable existence of the unit root is being given by the behavior, the short-term interest rate. So be careful always when you do your analysis. Remember what you have calculated, what kind of variables are you using. Take, for example, separate tests for the actual stock market returns. Basically, they might be behaving like a non-stationary series, but if they, together with the short-term interest rate, they build up a linear relationship between each other that actually is behaving like stationary series. We'll be discussing about that soon. So then in that case, actually, you might actually be able to use the excess returns also as such without taking the difference of the excess returns. Here I have calculated also the test for the log values of the economic policy uncertainty variables in the US and Euro area and UK, but since that we have not been discussing about those yet, and it's actually one of the things that we actually did only in the paper, I won't go through those because we are basically, for educational purposes, it would be just making a decision whether you are focusing on a stationary or non-stationary series. But here's actually one other example that is very easy to do. This is so-called Siewert-Andrews test for the structural changes in the data generating process of the variables. And here we first do that. I have also downloaded that to the same folder. And we are now, the Euro area real economic activity seemed to be like a stationary process. But when you take a look at that data series by drawing the figures, you were able to find out that it actually drastically changes around the global financial crisis. So it might be useful to take into account that there might be a structural change in the data generating process. And this Siewert and Andrews test actually is doing the test for that, whether there is a breakpoint. And it does the augmented Dickey Fuller type testing for the existence of a unit root after it has allowed for a break in the intercept series of the Euro DLY12. So it's using also information criteria once again, and it gives you an idea whether there is a statistically significant breakpoint in the series and around the period of global financial crisis, actually in the real economic activity in the Euro area, it's detecting a breakpoint. So this breakpoint actually might be disturbing your test statistics. And actually now that we are taking care of that, it doesn't help us very much in taking the final inference about the real economic activity, because we end up into a situation where at the 5% significance level, we might be, at 1% significance level, we might be doing the risk level, we might be doing the wrong decision, but at 5% level, if we are saying that the series is stationary, we are doing the right decision there. There is a breakpoint at around 2008 April that has a role there, and it's actually reporting the actual regression model that is using for to reveal the breakpoint, and the breakpoint is there significant at the 5% significance level. So this reported test statistics is for the unit test after adopting or modifying the fitted series, calculating a fitted series for the Euro variable Euro real economic activity by using this kind of specification for that. So it's imposing the lagged values of the dependent variable. So it's imposing, it's doing the Dickey-Fuller test because it's calculating that for the differences of the Euro area activity. It's including the lagged term like is in the original Dickey-Fuller test, constant trend, and dummies for capturing the effects that it is able to, or the lagged values of the left-hand side variable and the dummy variable that is capturing the effect of the structural change. So it is doing this estimation many, many times and calculating the Schwartz Bayesian information criteria and trying to minimize that one. And then it's reporting that for the best criteria that is based on this Bayesian information criteria using lags of 3 for the left-hand side variable in the Dickey-Fuller test. It's a bit complicated thing, but it's actually when you are able to see that in the original series you have some breakpoints. Something goes down more or less completely and stays down for a longer period of time, like was the case for the real economic activity in the Euro area. Actually, it might be relevant to control for those effects in your unit root tests. We have not discussed about this actually in the lectures, but this is something, and you won't be actually doing this either in the, I don't remember whether you are doing that in the demonstrations, but this is something that I usually always take a look at also when I find out that in the original series that something that there's something that happens. The levels of the series or the V-value of the series changes a lot after a shock. So I do this Zivot-Andrews type testing also. I did also for the other cases, so I will download this code so you can take a look at it and perhaps practice it with the free trial version of the RATS if you're interested in using RATS. But there's also Zivot-Andrews is actually available also in the R, but it was not, I think it's not available in Stata, but it's at least there in R. So you can use these kind of procedures also in R. But nevertheless, this was just an example that gives you an idea about the relevance of doing various kinds of unit root tests. Because actually when we did this with Juuso in our original paper, something like 3 years ago, first time, we were a bit irritated about these unit root test results for these variables that we are considering, and we found out that it's actually very relevant to take care of these structural changes in the series, and this actually gave us a reasoning for why we want to focus especially on the period after the global financial crisis, because things changed after that quite a lot. And actually, in our paper, we find the result that the forecasting ability of the funds market variables combined with the EPU variables has changed in the global funds crisis quite a lot. And we get the first stage indication for that already from the unit tests. All right. So, yeah.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
So when we did the augmented Dickey-Fuller test, we get the box with 4 rows.
Yeah.
Are the last 2 rows referring to the tau mu test that was talked about?
You mean this one?
Yeah, last 2.
Joint test of a unit root and no constant. So it's not imposing in the alternative. It's not imposing the constant. The first one, coefficient, and the t-statistic on the constant. So it's reporting the t-statistic and the coefficient here on the constant separately. And this is a joint test of a unit root and no constant. So it's first reporting this, and this is a joint test for that. And this is behaving a bit differently. So basically you get here the inference that you don't have the unit root. The critical values are not behaving here in the same way as in the Dickey-Fuller test. So pay attention to this report actually. Make the decision, because this is comparable to all the other cases here, like Phillips-Perron test, and also in comparison to the Coppe assays. So basically do your inferences based on this first. This is the standard Dickey-Fuller test. It's taking care of the lag structure or the autocorrelation in the residuals. This is just for reporting the coefficient. And these are very different in various programs. So for example, in R, you don't get these results. And in Windrush, this procedure has been built to be reporting also these things. So the main thing here is to do the inference based on a comparable test statistic to other test statistics. And it is this one, the augmented Dickey-Fuller test in this case. And you can compare that to the Phillips-Perron test from this representation. And then the KPSS test here for the null hypothesis of stationarity. Did I answer to your question?
Do we want the constant to be significant or not, or does it not matter?
It doesn't matter. That is actually the main message, that it doesn't matter in this case, because here you are actually doing the comparison to the intercept case, and whether you are able to get the same kind of inference that you did get from the ADF test. That. So basically, you are reporting here coefficient and t-statistic on the constant. So this is a t-statistic, and it's very low. So it would be referring that the constant is not actually important here. Okay, do you understand?
Yep.
And then you have here the case where you have imposed actually the intercept also. So does it end up into having a different result? So compare this, because you have calculated the test statistics. The test statistics are reported originally for this statistics. Compare that inference to the Phillips-Perron test, and then those together to the KPSS case, and then do the final decision. And if you are running up into a situation where these inferences from Dickey-Fuller and Phillips-Perron, they are in somehow disturbing compared to the inferences for the KPSS result, then actually I advise you to take next, not so much focus on the alternative hypothesis in the test equations, but more likely to the possibility that you have structural breaks in your data generating process of your time series. And that is the case for Zivot-Andres test. And as you saw already from that Estima website, there are plenty of other possibilities for testing also these structural breaks. And each of those one are a bit different. But this is a test that is designed to be discussed in connection to the augmented Dickey-Fuller test statistics, because this is actually using the same kind of representation for the test equation as is the original augmented Dickey-Fuller test statistic. Okay, so it's trying to find the change in the intercept or the constant term in this regression model based on the Bayesian information criteria. When it finds the minimum value, so it imposes for each and every time point in the data series, it imposes this dummy variable and estimates the model and saves the Bayesian information criteria. And when it finds the lowest information criteria value, then it reports the test statistic for the Dickey-Fuller test, and then it actually also, so the, it reports this one, this first one here, and then all the other parameter estimates also from the actual regression model for testing for the unit root. In intuitive terms, this is actually quite nice paper. Okay, so my computer time is now 10:45, so perhaps we can have a 10 minutes break now. So you can have a cup of coffee and let's continue from this 5 to 11. Okay, let's continue now. And let's move on now to the next stage of the time series analysis of using non-stationary variables. So that is obviously the case where we want to extend our analysis to a case of more than one variable. So then we start the discussion about co-integration. So in most cases, if we are to combine two variables that are integrated of order one, then the combination will also be, in most cases, it will also be integrated of order one, which means that the combination or the linear representation between the variables, it's still non-stationary. But if we end up into a situation that actually it's possible to get a combination of these variables that is actually stationary, then it opens us a possibility to do some further deeper analysis or digging deeper of the dynamic relationships between these variables in terms of long-term relationships and short-term relationships. So in general terms, if we combine variables with different orders of integration, the combination will have an order of integration that is equal to the largest one. So if the variable vector xit is integrated of order di for any of the variables, we have k variables each integrated of order di, then if we let the linear combination of those variables, so basically this is representing like a linear regression between those variables, so this is reflecting actually an error term from a linear regression between the x variables. So if it's the case that this error term, linear representation of the linear combination between the variables, it's integrated of the maximum order of the differentiation for the individual variables, then we have a case where we might have co-integration between the variables. So linear combinations of non-stationary variables means that we are considering whether in this kind of representation of the data, we can normalize this vector of the variables by so that we treat one by one all the variables as the dependent variable. So if we denote the first variable in the vector of x variables to be x1, let's say that it's this real economic activity, then when we are doing co-integration analysis for these variables, we are explaining the observations of real economic activity with the observations of term spread and, for example, excess return from the stock markets. So if these guys together built up a stationary relationship, so if we can find a regression model where the real economic activity can be explained by the excess returns plus the effect of the term spread, then it's resulting, if they are co-integrated, it's resulting to a stationary series for the residuals. So let's see. This set here refers to the stationary series. So basically, we can analyze the effects of these individual right-hand side variables here based on normalizing for the coefficient for the first variable in this variable vector here. So this is just basically a regression equation. It's a regression equation for the contemporaneous observations between the variables. So for this case, we actually have these disturbances set here. They might be not stationary, and they might be autocorrelated if all these variables in the original vector are not stationary. So they might be also, these sets might be also not stationary, non-stationary. For this to be a valid regression model, we would like to get into a situation where the disturbances, these set variables, they are not unitary processes. They are stationary. So what would be the circumstances that we could end up with in this kind of situation? Let's assume that this vector of disturbances is a k times one vector of variables. Then the components of this disturbances vector, they are co-integrated of order dB if all the components of Z are ID, and there is at least one vector of coefficient alpha that sort of meets this requirement that it is integrated of a lower vector than are the individual components in the Z. So this means that this is integrated of a lower degree. So it's an empirical finding, as we have already discussed regarding, for example, that data series, these data series that we have been using in these examples, is that they are non-stationary, but they may move together over time, especially within certain subsamples. So if the variables are co-integrated, it actually implies that there might be a linear combination of those variables that could be stationary. So the linear combination actually then refers to this Z series, this here. There is a linear combination of the X variables that might be stationary. So obviously there might be up to R linearly independent co-integration relationships where the R is equal or smaller to the number of variables K minus one. So this is the case where we have more than two variables. In case of three variables, basically we could have two co-integration vectors between the variables. So by definition, in the literature that this co-integration analysis has started to develop, we refer to these co-integration relationships as the long-term relationships. And I will show you in practical terms what does it actually mean in terms of doing the analysis for the data. And this is actually something that has been developed originally for the applications, especially in economics and finance. We do not see very much discussions about co-integration or unitary processes in most of the other applications that are using time series methods. So for example, in the original book by Box and Jenkins and others, it didn't, the first two editions didn't actually include at all discussions about integration and co-integration. They only started to appear there since the third edition, since the Engle-Granger analysis appeared in the Econometrica in 1987. So it's quite a recent phenomenon, even though these guys have already received the Nobel Prize for this thing. But it is mostly in connection to the analysis of economic and funds of time series. So actually the reason for that is that the idea or the concept of co-integration gives us a possibility to discuss about the equilibrium relationships in the markets. Equilibrium relationship refers to a situation where there's basically no need for the variables to change, or if they go from some direction from the observations that they are having at the equilibrium, there is an error correction mechanism that brings them back to that long run steady state value actually. That error correction mechanism is based on the dynamics between the relevant variables that we are considering now in the model. So examples of possible co-integration relationships in financial applications are, for example, the spot and futures prices analysis and ratio of relative prices and an exchange rate. So then in this case, we are talking about the purchasing power parity things. So in the international finance course, you will be actually discussing about these things and also equity prices and dividends. There are lots of studies that have applied unitude and integration and co-integration and error correction modeling to equity prices and the dividends, dividend streams from the individual individual firms. Market forces arising from no arbitrage conditions should ensure an equilibrium relationship. This is the major idea why these models have been especially applied in financial applications. No co-integration implies that series could wander about without bound in the long run. If there's no co-integration, there's also no long-run equilibrium relationship between the variables that you are considering in your model. So basically, you should actually get an idea for the testing equation for this co-integration. So if you were to use some kind of unit testing, then perhaps it could be something that is applied to a residual series from a standard linear regression model for two variables. So you get the residual from that one. If they are not connected to each other in co-integration sense, there's no actually long-term trends in these variables that would be moving together, then it is not possible to actually end up with a stationary residual series from their regression model. So basically, perhaps it actually is about testing for the stationarity of the residual series from this starting regression model. And that is actually the main idea. When this concept was first considered, a user response was to independently take the first differences of a series of I1 variables. And the problem with this approach is that the pure differential models do not have actually a long-run solution. And this is the thing that Engle and Granger actually proved in their econometrica paper. So basically, the model that we may want to estimate looks like this. So if we are satisfied with the idea that we don't have any kind of long-term relationship for the levels of the variables y and x, then we are focusing basically on the differences of the variables only. We might be interested in revealing the dynamics between the differences, but nevertheless, in that case, we are still talking about the short-term relationships. But in terms of short-term dynamics between the changes in these variables. So this collapses to nothing in the long run. We don't have a long run levels dependence between the variables at all. So the definition of the long run here comes from these steady state ideas in economic models. For example, in the growth theory, we have an idea about the steady state values of the capital ratio and GDP per capita. So we have this kind of a golden rule for the investments, amount of investments that is should be done in order to get to the long run steady state values for the growth rate. So this is actually referring to these kind of ideas. So the definition of the long run that we use here, that there's no reason for variable y actually to be very much different at the moment compared to the last value. So it's converging to a constant value in the long run. And basically the same applies also to the other variable. But there is some kind of relationship between these two guys that actually is being driven by their long-term relationship between each other. So all the difference terms in this case, in the steady state relationship between the variables, they will be zero. There's no need for the change in the y, or there's no need for the change in the x. They are in the long-term equilibrium values. And in terms of using error correction or co-integration analysis, we are interested about this, whether there is, based on statistical behavior, time series behavior of the data series, is it possible to detect this kind of situation between the variables? That is the main thing here. So when we start to specify an error correction model, it's obviously the most easiest way to do for a set of two variables. So let's consider only y and x in this case. So in a so-called error correction representation, we should be able to find a situation or the dynamic dependency between the variables that is reflecting the idea that, yeah, if there comes a change in the xt, then it's obviously affecting also on the yt. So we have economic reasoning for this, that changes in the x should be affecting also changes in y. So this is the first term here. But then we have also, based on some kind of pricing mechanism or no arbitrage condition in the long run, for example, from the financial markets, we have an idea that the prices or the levels of the variables y and x, they should be in connection to each other in long term. So if there comes a change in the level of this x, it's actually affecting to also to the level of the yt, and they together, how far apart is this x from yt in the previous period, they together have an effect on the changes in yt. And try to remember from the very first beginning of this co-integration or error correction ideas that the error correction framework or the error correction idea doesn't basically apply at all if this coefficient on the levels term here, the long-term co-integration relationship, if this coefficient is not negative. Because in that case, when the y is very far from xt and it does have, for example, a value of 0.5 here, when it's far, it's increasing the difference in the yt, even though this would not be increasing very much. So in order to have an error correction, so in order to have a sort of a reversal effect with regards to the difference between the long-term values of y and x, this has to be negative. Otherwise, it's not correcting the error between the long-term variables or long-term values. So this has to be negative. So if you were to be able to derive a valid error correction representation for the variables, you should end up into a situation where the beta 2 value is minus. It's negative, it's minus something. And this long-term relationships is usually denoted to be the so-called error correction term. Providing that these original levels observations of yt and xt, they are co-integrated with the co-integration coefficient of gamma, then this difference between the last values or previous values of yt minus gamma times xt, it should be stationary series, even though x and y are I1. This was the major finding in the Engle-Granger paper in Econometrica. They were able to, based on the simulation exercises for the non-stationary variables, that in some cases it is actually possible to find these kind of relationships when the variables are co-integrated. And so basically in this case, we can actually estimate this error correction model using OLS because everything is stationary here. This is stationary, even though originally Y1, YT and XT, they are non-stationary, their differences are stationary, and this error correction term is also stationary because it's producing a stationary error correction or the series for the residuals when you regress on this one. And so everything here is behaving nicely in terms of the requirements for the regressor error term in this regression equation. So the so-called Granger representation theorem says that any co-integration relationship can be expressed as an equilibrium correction model. So basically, if you find co-integration between the variables, you should be able to build up also an error correction model for those. But even though originally you should be able to do that, pay attention to the final estimation or the parameter estimates that you get from the error correction model. Are they valid? This should be negative and statistically significantly different from zero in order to have a proper error correction model. So testing for co-integration in regression means that the model for the equilibrium correction term can be generalized to include more than two variables. And in this case, when you have more than two variables, so you have more than just one x here on the right-hand side, you should actually note that you might have more than only one co-integration relationship. And that is actually referring to the using of a bit different modeling procedure that is titled to be the so-called Johansen procedure, invented by a Danish econometrician Søren Johansen. We won't be going through that in much details in these lectures, but I will download to the Moodle site one paper of mine that uses the Johansen procedure, and it explains the practical usefulness of that procedure also. You should get an idea about the why is it relevant to use a Johansen procedure in certain circumstances from that paper. So the main thing here is that nevertheless, regardless of how many variables you have, if you have co-integration between the variables, it should be possible to get an I0 or I0 series for the residuals in the regression model, if the variables in the model are co-integrated. So this is basically the standard linear regression model that we started from in this course, but now we are imposing some interesting characteristics to the data generating processes of these time series that we are analyzing. So what we want to test is if the residuals of this equation are stationary or non-stationary. That is the simple idea in co-integration analysis. And we can use, Engle and Granger proved this, that we can use the augmented Dickey-Fuller and Dickey-Fuller tests on these residual series. So basically we have the regression of changes in this residual. So this is resembling the standard augmented or the original Dickey-Fuller test. So we are testing for the changes and explaining their behavior by the lagged values of that same residual. So first estimate this regression equation, save the residuals, generate the differences from those, and explain the differences in the residuals with the lagged levels of the residuals. So this is a test of the residuals of an actual model. So the critical values are a bit changed once again, and Engle and Granger actually produced these new critical values. And you don't have to actually nowadays even take a look at the Engle-Granger paper anymore. If you are using co-integration analysis in the econometric programs, they report the critical test also. But nevertheless, we can use, for example, the Durbin-Watson test statistics or the Phillips-Peronopoulos actually to test for the non-stationary Dickey-Fuller. I will have to repair that. So what are the null and alternative hypotheses for a test on the residuals of a potentially co-integrated regression? Here's the main thing that you have to remind yourselves. in building up this test equation. The null hypothesis here is once again that there's a unit root in the co-integration regressions residuals. So what does this imply for the existence of co-integration? Can anyone give an idea? Let's say you are doing a regression of y against x1 and x2. You save the residuals and test for the existence of unit roots in this regression. So you use, let's say, augmented Dickey-Fuller test for testing the existence of unit roots in these residual series. So if you are imposing the test for co-integration using this Dickey-Fuller test statistics, and the null hypothesis is that unit root is there in the residuals, what does this indicate for the co-integration between yt and x's, x1 and x2?
They are not co-integrated.
Exactly. So the null hypothesis for the actual variables that you are interested about is that there's no co-integration. And the alternative, so it's a bad thing for you. If you end up accepting the null hypothesis that there's no co-integration, then actually based on the Engel-Granger theorem, you are not actually able to also build up an error correction model for these variables. So for the purposes of building an error correction model, you should end up rejecting the null hypothesis. So the residuals from the co-integration regression are stationary. In that case only, you are able to build up an error correction model. So if you jump directly to the estimation of the error correction representation for the data, so if you jump directly to this stage of your modeling, then you are sort of making a wrong step there, taking a wrong step in terms of taking a really, really close look at whether you have co-integration or not. So don't go directly to the estimation of error correction model unless you have first tested for co-integration. This is the main message from the Engel-Granger paper in econometric. So there are at least three methods. There are lots of other methods also, but the most actively used ones are these Engel-Granger, Engel and Yaw method, a three-step method, and then this Johansen method that is applied to the case where you have more than two variables usually. But let's now go more thoroughly through this Engel-Granger two-step method, because it's very intuitive terms. It's easy to do, and it's also easy to understand the main concepts regarding the building of error correction model when you use this Engel-Granger step. And this is something that I want you to do in your home assignments. So the first step is to start from taking a look at the individual series. Take a look at the Y series and take a look at the X series in your model, and make sure that all the individual variables are I1. Because if they are not I1, they are not of the same degree of non-stationarity. Then you are not able to build up, in a co-integration sense, a long-term relationship between those. So if you want to end up to an error correction model, you want to be able to construct a model that captures the short-term effects and the long-term effects in an error-correcting nature of the model, then you have to first do the unit root test for the individual variables. If you are able to find that you have a set of variables that are of same degree of integration, so this D here is of same degree, usually I1, then estimate the co-integration regression using OLS. So do the analysis for the levels of the variables. save the residuals of the co-integration regression, as I already mentioned, test the residuals to ensure that they are I zero. So if you want to build up a error correction model, you have to test for this. And then in step two, use these step one residuals as one additional variable in the error correction model. Because basically, this is actually now referring to the linear relationship between Y and X. So basically, you have estimated that you have saved the residuals, lack those by one period, and then do the step two regression using the difference values, because this original has been proved to be an I1 variable. Then when you take a difference of that, it's I0. And this other guy also has been proved to be an I1 variable. Take a difference of that, then it's I0. And these, if they are co-integrated to X and Y, then their series, residual series from their linear regression should also be a I0 variable or I0 series. You can lack that one. So basically, this residual series, this hat U, is the observation from previous period minus this estimated parameter estimate on the effects of X's from the last period or the previous period. So we expect in practical applications, let's take an example of this to open up the idea in more deeper way. Let's take an example from finance literature. Let's analyze a lead-lag relationship between spot and futures prices. So we expect changes in the spot price of a financial asset and its corresponding futures price to be more or less perfectly contemporaneously correlated and not to be cross-autocorrelated in terms of the efficiency of the markets. So for the contemporaneous observations, we do have this kind of idea that the futures prices, changes in the log values of the futures prices and changes in the log values of spot prices should be very strongly correlated. So we are now focusing on the log returns here. Log returns from the futures markets and log returns from the spot markets. You will be doing these in all the exercises. You will be using these log returns mainly. But based on the ideas of market efficiency, it should not be the case that actually the previous spot prices would be of much use in forecasting the futures price, futures price changes. And on the other hand, the past values of the futures returns should not be able to forecast. Well, they should not be useful in trying to somehow forecast the current returns of spot markets. So basically, these are the things that we are interested about, whether there is some kind of arbitrage possibilities. We are now focusing on the dynamic dependencies between these returns. We try to build up a co-integration relationship in order to test for these efficiency ideas that we have. So we can test this idea by modeling the lead-lag relationship between the returns series. And there are two papers by Tse and Brooks and others that we will be going through. In the first one, they have over 1,000 daily observations on the stock index and stock index futures from December 1988 to April 1993. And in the other paper, they have over 13,000. So this is high frequency data from 10-minute observations on the FTSE 100 stock index and stock index futures rising for all trading days in the period of 1 year observations from the UK markets actually. So what is the idea? What is the theoretical model? The model is based on this. This model will be, for example, this model will be covered in your course on a derivatives course, for example, and probably also in the international finance course. So this is the relationship, theoretical relationship that should be valid for the dependency of futures prices on the spot market prices. So F star, uppercase F star is here the so-called fair futures price. that should be determined by the spot price quotation in the markets, and R is a continuously compounded risk-free rate, so the other component is the risk-free rate, and D is the continuously compounded yield in terms of dividends derived from the stock index until the futures contract matures. So this is one of the fundamentals. So basically, here we have also a relationship that gives you an idea about the relevant things as fundamentals that have an effect on the pricing of financial market assets. So futures prices are affected by spot prices, risk-free interest rate, continuously compounded yields in terms of dividends, and actually the time to maturity of the agreement. So this T, uppercase T minus lowercase T, is the time to maturity of the futures contract. Now, when we take logarithms, we want to analyze the log differences of the prices because they are our return variables. So take log values of this equation and you are able to get into a kind of a linear relationship for the levels of futures prices and spot prices, but using log values. So basically, in terms of the regression model, you have a time series for spot prices, take a log of that. You have a time series for, time series for futures prices, take a log of that. Time series of spot prices, take a log of that. And then additional relevant things in terms of the theoretical model. So this is so-called, in this case, we can denote this to be the so-called cost of carry element. That is actually basically only dependent on the time to maturity of the futures contract. So this is like a constant term that is dependent on the time to maturity of each of the considered futures contracts. So these are the relevant things. So if these change, they have a constant level, constant wise effect on the futures prices. But for each and every agreement, we assume that these R and D don't change very much. So they are risk-free interest rate. So we don't have this time notation for these at all because they are dependent on the time to maturity of the futures contract. Okay, so this is the so-called cost of carry component. What would we do in terms of time series analysis? We basically start from the simple regression of futures prices against spot prices. If we take log differences of those, then we are considering log returns. So let's start from doing the log Dickey-Fuller or the unit tests for the log prices and returns. What can you say about whether there is, these are so clear test statistics. So these are the test statistics for testing the existence of unitaries in prices and also in returns. What can you say about the unitaries?
The log prices have unitaries, are non-stationary.
Yeah. What about returns?
They are not.
So the prices are non-stationary, so they are Y1 variables, and the changes in the prices, changes in the log prices are stationary. So based on these results, what would you say, Kimmo, are you able to use co-integration analysis for futures and spot prices?
Yes, I might be able to.
Yes, the next step is because you are able to say that these are of integration of same degree. So they are integrated of the first degree. So this is an I1 and this is an I1, and both of those are I0s. So they are stationary in differences. Log of F and log of S, they are not stationary, but delta log of F and delta log of S, they are stationary. But if you are interested about long-term relationships, then you should not just end up estimating the first differences model. So let's try to find out whether there is a co-integration relationship between the lock prices of futures and spot prices. So the potential co-integration regression looks like this. So basically, we are now imposing here that same z that we actually discussed. So this is basically now that x vector of the variables that we started the discussion about. S, it's x is now composed of s and f. So log values of spot prices and log values of futures. So we are building up a regression model for these guys. And basically now in this representation, this first guy here is actually now capturing all the cost of carry things in our analysis. So we are sort of putting all those effects to the constant term here. So let's estimate this regression and save these residuals, denote them as z hat, and test whether they are stationary. So what can you say about co-integration between the variables here? Are they co-integrated or not? So this is the regression equation. Constant term is this gamma zero, and the coefficient on the futures prices is gamma one. And this is the error term. So we are imposing the Dickey-Fuller test statistics on the error term.
Yes, they are.
Yes, they are co-integrated. First of all, you get that result simply based on taking a view at the test statistics. But another thing that actually gives you an idea that they might be co-integrated is this coefficient on the futures prices, log value of futures prices. It's very close to one. So in long term, the levels of spot prices and futures actually are correlated with a high degree of correlation. So basically the first idea that we had there, that it should be the case, it's now actually working in this data. Cost of carry term here, we would have to make the final decision about its relevance actually based on the statistical significance. We are not reporting that at this stage here, but it will be shown that it also might have a role to play. But nevertheless, the Z observations are stationary, and therefore we have a co-integration relationship between log of F and log of S. The next step in the Engle-Granger procedure is to use the first stage residuals, or the final step is to use those as the equilibrium correction term, long run equilibrium term in the general equation. So the overall final model that we will be estimating, that you can do only after you have tested for the co-integration. You cannot do that. If you were here to accept the null hypothesis of no co-integration, then you cannot basically build up this. You should end up using only differences, and only you would only able to estimate the dynamic dependencies in short-term intervals, meaning that the differences. So you would, if you don't find co-integration between the levels, obviously you don't have to stop there and do nothing further. Start doing the analysis for the dynamic dependency using VAR models for the differenced prices or the returns, because they still might be in connection to each other. But it's nice to find out now that we have these relationships. So it's actually relevant based on the Engle-Granger representation theorem. It's actually relevant to represent that pricing equation for the spot prices in this form. So the returns from the spot markets are affected by a constant term plus the lagged changes in the spot. So this is the AR part, and this is the co-integration part for the short-term effects. So F changes in the F. So the returns from the futures market are affecting also the spot prices. So we are interested in terms of market efficiency, whether these parameter estimates are statistically significant or not. But the most important thing that we are able to find based on the co-integration ideas is this long-term equilibrium error correction term here. And if is this is where this were supposed to be a really valid error correction representation, then we should have some kind of ideas about the sign of this parameter estimate. So how does this turn out to be? Is it a valid error correction representation for the data? Here we have also the t ratio for the cost of carry component. So it's marginally significant, not perhaps very, very important, but nevertheless, let's include that also. But what about the validity of the error correction representation?
It's negative, so it's valid.
Yeah, it's valid, and it's clearly statistically significant because t-ratio is minus 5 point something. So this is minus 0.83, so it actually is very statistically significant, and it has the right sign in terms of theoretical a priori assumptions. What about the short-term effects? Are they relevant?
Yes, because they are statistically significant.
Yeah, they are statistically significant. So if there comes a 1 percentage point change in the futures returns, then it will have a 0.18 percentage point effect on, alpha 1, 0.13 percentage point effect on the spot returns, and it's statistically significant. So there is a kind of a dynamic dependency. So the basic efficiency hypothesis of the markets doesn't actually apply, because you can make use of the information in the past history of futures markets when you try to forecast the future spot prices or spot returns. So basically, there is a possibility for arbitrage in these markets, actually, based on our representation. We would not have been basically able to reveal this if we were not using this kind of co-integration or error correction representation. So main question is now, is it possible to make any financial profits or use this for business purposes? Is it useful for you to use this for business purposes? So basically, the main thing is now that we would like to forecast the next one step ahead forecast values based on these various forecasting models. So error correction model refers to the case where we only have these guys excluding the cost of carry term there, because it was only marginally perhaps significant because the t-ratio is so low there. And in this case, we have that included, even though it might be not so relevant. Here is a simple ARIMA model where we only have tried to determine the best possible ARIMA representation, and it actually proved out to be an ARIMA 111 case in this data. I think it was the case. And the VAR representation is here for the differences between the, so this is an ARIMA model for spot returns, so it's a univariate model, and this is a VAR model excluding the co-integration term there, or that long-term equilibrium relationship. So this is only for the differences. We calculate the root mean squared error values. So we are generating one step ahead forecast from each and every one of these models, save those, compare those to the actual values in the next period, and then based on all these observations, calculate the root mean squared errors of those forecasts. Calculate the mean absolute errors of those same things, and then also you can calculate the percentage of correct directions. So based on these, statistics. What can you say about the forecasting accuracy of the models? Which one of the models would seem to be the best?
The second one.
Yeah, the second one, based on just these statistical accuracy, statistical performance measures, based on root mean squared values, you actually get the lowest value here in the error correction model with the cost of carry term, so the constant term is included there. Mean absolute error is also the smallest. In terms of the percentage of correct predictions, it actually also gives the best model because it has the highest percentage. So the main question is now that is it in economic terms or in terms of financial profits from your investment strategy, is it useful to use this? So obviously we should be comparing various trading strategies that are, at least some of those are based on these models. So based, let's use this best model in terms of statistical performance to building up a trading strategy. So the trading strategy involves analyzing the forecast for the spot return based on this best model here and incorporating the decision dictated by the trading rules described below. So there are various possibilities to build up a trading rule. Basically, the trading rules or trading ideas are always based on the actual behavior of the data. Make some decisions about which of the observations are relevant for your decision making. And we assume that the original investment is of the amount of £1,000. If the holding in the stock index is zero, the investment earns the risk-free rate. First strategy is this liquid trading strategy, which means that we are making a so-called round-trip trade, purchase and sale of this FTSE, the underlying stocks that we are focusing on, in every 10 minutes, and then the return is predicted to be positive by the model. The second one is a buy and hold strategy when the forecast is a positive strategy. It allows the trader to continue holding the indices. The return at the next predicted investment period is positive. Filter strategy. First filter strategy is the one where we have we make the decision based on the better predicted return than average. It so gives you an indication or signal to invest into the index only if the predicted returns are greater than the average positive return. Next, second filter strategy is that if we decide to take a look at the actual return data and your predicted return is better than the first decile data, so only the returns predicted to be the top 10% of the all the returns they are traded on. Final filter strategy is high arbitrage cutoff, which means that an arbitrary filter of 0.0075 is imposed to the returns. So if the returns are not higher, then don't invest. So what are the messages from here? This actually gives you a nice idea about these trading strategies, whether they are useful or not. Would you engage into using any of these strategies that are based on the error correction model incorporating the cost of carry? Or which one of these would seem to be the preferable one? The original investment is £1,000. The first strategy gives you terminal wealth of these, so you can calculate the return, annualized return, based on those that you get from here and compare basically those to each other. And what is the terminal wealth with slippage and with the annualized return with slippage. And here is the number of trades that are being required to execute these trading strategies. What is the main important thing here that is being left unreported?
The risk.
The risk is the first thing, that this is just about return. You are not reporting the risk-adjusted returns. That's good points. And Kimmo, do you have any other idea what might be relevant? What are the relevant information for you as a trader when you engage into actual trading in the markets, in addition to the risk?
I would say transaction costs.
Exactly. The second important thing is the transaction cost, and they are not being reported. So the best strategies in terms of the actual terminal wealth return, rates of return, either as annualized or in simply the measures of terminal wealth, are these ones. So these three in the middle, but those are actually the ones that also require the most active trading. So if you adjust the final returns based on the trading costs, you might actually end up into a worse situation compared to, for example, this passive investment strategy or this filter three here. They are not basically yielding very much as actually this last one especially, but the thing that is not being reported here is the trading costs. And another thing was that we are not reporting the risk-adjusted returns for this. Good. So the futures market leads the spot market because the stock index is not a single entity, so some components of the index are infrequently dated and they are in connection to each other. Spot and futures markets do indeed have a long-run relationship in terms of the levels of the prices. And it basically, after when you take into account the also the trading costs and riskiness of these various strategies, it might not be possible to profit actually from these lead lag relationships for the prices. So it's actually not perhaps profitable when you take into account all these relevant things that usually nowadays are also taken into account in the analysis of this efficient market hypothesis. So the idea was originally that based on our data, simply it has actually gives us a message that there is arbitrage possibilities. So the efficient market hypothesis is not working. You can use information from the prices from other markets to forecast the future prices or returns in the other markets. But when you take the economic or the financial profit point of view to these all these, then it's not probably even profitable, because it's actually indicating that you have to do a lot of trading. You have to do always, you have to be always on the terminal, basically, in these cases. Okay, so we have now discussed about the Engle-Granger approach here. And the main problem here is that in the Engle-Granger approach, we assume that the co-integration relationships is unique. And when you have more than two variables in your vector of variables, it might not be unique. And this is actually based on the idea in the VAR models that actually we observed yesterday that in the case of where we have more than two, in the case where we had five variables in that last example, the ordering of the variables seems to be actually relevant. It might change the inference regarding, for example, impulse responses and variance decompositions. So obviously, already based on this idea, when you are using these kind of dynamic models in the co-integration analysis for more than two variables, it might be the case that the parameter estimates that get to be estimated for the co-integration relationship, so meaning that set there, then they might be different when you change the order of the variables. That is the main message, actually. And that has been the main criticism against the Engle-Granger approach. And that was originally presented by Søren Johansen in his paper, also in Econometrica 1990 and 1992. And in Johansen approach, idea is to extend the Engle-Granger analysis to the case of more than two variables. There's also this Engle and Yaw approach to solve some of the problems in the Engle-Granger, original Engle-Granger analysis. And it's more like for solving this problem about the actual co-integration regressions that was actually referring to already. So it takes first the two steps from the Engle-Granger procedure, and then it adds a third step by giving the updated estimates of the co-integration vector and its standard errors. And it's basically this actually runs into the same problem that the estimated co-integration vectors are not unique. So basically the thing that has been applied in most of the cases when you have more than two variables in your variable vector is this Johansen method. I won't go through this into much details, but if any one of you is interested in using this method, there are the next 20 slides are giving you the details of that method, how to do the tests for the number of co-integration vectors in this Johansen procedure approach. It gives you a detailed analysis or the discussion about, but the main thing is that actually you end up into this same kind of representation of the data that we ended up in vector autoregressive models. So basically you can do these same kind of discussions using this Johansen method where you end up to a vector representation of the data. So you can basically use VAR type models and generate also the variance decompositions and impulse responses from these co-integrated systems where you have applied Johansen method. So for those of you, I won't require this application of Johansen method in the home assignment, but it's obviously might be useful for some of you who are more interested in doing this, let's say, in the macroeconomic contents, because in the macroeconomic contents it's relevant to really find the relevant long-term relationships between the variables, not perhaps so much in the financial market applications. And for this purpose, if any one of you wants to take a look at of a practical application in addition to these given in the slides, I will show you also one of my own papers or. Actually, I don't have it here now open, so I will give you a reference to a paper that I have where I have applied also these Johansen methods. It's not so, let's say, it's not so convenient to be used, for example, in R and Stata. R, you have this Johansen procedure available, but in RATS, actually, you have to use a specific program called Co-Integration Analysis of Time Series that has been designed by Søren Johansen and Katarina Juselius, who is his wife. She's a Finnish econometrician once again. And Mikael Juselius, their son, has been involved also to the development of this procedure. So if any one of you wants to use Johansen procedure in the future, come back to me and let's discuss about the relevant sources for information for that. I can give you examples on how to run the procedure in more details, and it's easiest to be done using WinRATS. You can do that also, for example, in eViews, but it's not easy to do in Stata. And in R you can do that also, but it requires a certain amount of coding if you are interested about using that in R. Okay, so I won't be requiring, but for those of you that are interested especially in macro applications in these co-integration sense, then take a look at the Johansen procedure, and I will download an example article for using the Johansen procedure that is actually also based on my own PhD dissertation 20 years ago. So you can take a look at that one. So that's it for this time, and next week we will be continuing from the discussion of risk models. So basically we will be discussing about the various forms of GARCH models that are used to be modeling for the risks in the financial markets. Okay, thank you. That's pretty much that, and have a nice weekend. Does anyone have any questions?
I actually have one.
Yeah.
So if we have a non-stationary variable, is it so that it can't be normally distributed?
Basically, yeah, it can't be normally distributed if you have a non-stationary variable, because its values are either increasing most of the time or they are decreasing most of the time, and they might be doing, well, basically, you might have a case but where you have a normally distributed variable, but usually it's not. And at least in a regression where you use the non-stationary variables against each other, if they are not co-integrated, then it actually doesn't result into a normally distributed error term. And that is actually the problematic thing there. If you are using these non-stationary variables in regression models, what is the implication of this non-stationarity in the time series to the behavior of the residual in that regression model? That's the main thing, actually. How does the residual from the regression model behave when you are using non-stationary variables? Do you get the idea?
Yeah. And actually, I had another question regarding that. So do we make any another assumption about normal distributions of variables, for example? I mean, I think we assume that the residuals are normally distributed, but do we need the variables to be?
Not necessary if they are producing a, let's say, for example, a co-integration relationship in this co-integration analysis. If they are producing a linear relationship between each other that is resulting into a residual series or this Z series that is behaving like a normally distributed variable. If they are combining them together, they result into a linear representation between those. So the residual basically from that co-integration regression behaves normally. That is the key thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So start, just to recap, start from these unit root tests always, because they are part of the descriptive statistics nowadays. If you find co-integrated variables more than one, if you have at least two variables that are co-integrated, just take a look at whether they are co-integrated also. So is it actually relevant in also in economic terms, in based on your theory, is it actually relevant that they might be forming together a linear relationship that is stationary? Then introduce this stationary relationship to your model covering the other variables also. So that is actually something. So that you would end up into a situation where you only have stationary variables in your final regression model. That is the key thing. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So for the next Monday's demonstration, you should have already the codes there, or at least the questions there, and the codes will be there at least tomorrow also, so that you can practice already for the next Monday's demonstration. And next week we will be discussing about the risk, modeling the risk in the financial markets. And that is actually the perhaps one of the most interesting things currently that I'm also doing myself also. Okay. So if there's no other questions, then have a nice weekend and see you next week. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.